In this special episode of Because It Matters, we're recording live from Architects Connect 2025 at the Battersea Power Station in London. Today's topic, security in architecture. What defines trust in a city? Where does the balance lie between openness and safety in architectural design? And how might the concept of freedom evolve in our urban environments? To tackle these questions, our guest today is Ed Parham, Director of Innovation and Design at Space Syntax. Let's explore the world of safe, secure, and seamless access solutions together with our host, Wilma Werner.
Ladies and gentlemen, a warm welcome to this special episode of Because It Matters, the Dormakaba podcast. And as you can see, we're not in Ennepetal right now. We are at a very special location. We are at the Art Hotel in Battersea, London, UK. And if you could see what I see, you would be able to see the famous Battersea Power Station here in London, because it's right across the street, which is a lovely view. And this connects to the event that takes place right at the moment. It is the Architects Connect 2025, hosted by Dormakaba. And this year, they do have a partnership with the RIBA, the Royal Institute of British Architects. And I am honored to have a special guest today on this episode of the podcast. Hello, Ed Parham. Welcome.
Hi,
great to have you here. Can you please briefly introduce yourself?
Yeah, so I'm an architect. I'm a RIBA member. I work for a company called Space Syntax. What we're really interested in is taking data, data on cities, really, analysing the built systems in cities, understanding how it affects the way that people use cities, and thinking or being able to consistently describe physical systems in order that you can relate them to the activities that happen on a daily basis and the long-term outcomes that happen as a result. So things like how easy it is to walk around a city and how that affects things like health or climate change or these kind of things.
Which connects beautifully to this year's topic of the Architects Connect 2025, spaces of trust. So when we talk about spaces of trust with you, it's not just a building, it's a whole city that we look at. So can you please share from your perspective, what defines trust in a city? If you walk through a city, how could you say, well, I trust that space?
So I think in a city context, I think it becomes really interesting. I think there's a series of things which are almost, if you think of trust, it's that you trust the building owner, the part of the city that you're in, that you're safe. And I think when you're in buildings or you're in a particularly clearly defined area, that's a really clear relationship because there's an owner and there's somebody who's in charge of it. I think where things become really interesting is what happens if you're not part of that group. So what happens if you are, there might be a luxury development. For it to be safe for a certain group of people, there might be a certain set of physical or non-physical barriers around things. That might make those people feel really safe. They will trust the owner or the people that run it. But what about the people that aren't part of that group? And I think that's where there's some really interesting things that we have to work through. I mean, one example, to make it a bit more tangible, if you zoom out a scale, if you think about things like gated developments, there's lots of residential developments that are gated. That makes those people feel really safe. Mm. But at the same time, that can break apart the city. It can increase the distances between things. It can make it more difficult to move around. And we know that that has a whole series of other impacts. So that makes it makes places car dependent. If it's more difficult to walk around, people do walk around less and they become at risk of other health conditions or things like climate change and emissions become worse. So there's something here about not just about trust and the relationship between a direct user, but there's this indirect user as well. I think there's another kind of interesting angle as well, which is the role of things like surveillance and data collection. And you see this a lot. You see this in the debate around things like pay-to-stay places or privatization of public space, essentially. And the problem being that people are collecting data all the time on stuff. And what happens to that data? It might be keeping the people safe inside that particular area, but somebody now has my data on a database. Mm. And what happens if they're using an algorithm to profile me or something like this? And there's a whole series of questions in there, which are why they're collecting data, what do you use it for? lots and lots of really difficult, knotty problems to talk through.
Plus, they seem to go into very different directions. So if you satisfy one goal, you dissatisfy the other.
Yeah.
So did you ever have the situation where you had to rethink a design because of security requirements or integrating different perspectives? So what does that look like?
I think some of this depends a lot on context, I think, of what the requirement might be. And I mean, just to give an example, I think there's, if you are in a context where you know there's a really strong security requirement, so like an airport, the moment you book the flight, you know there's, you can't do this, you have to do this, arrive 2 hours early, you get to the airport, there's a really clear process that is turned into a set of spaces, you know how far you are through the passport queue, through the security queue, all of this stuff.
Yeah.
And airports tend to be quite legible, that you can, you know roughly where you are. Where it becomes, again, more interesting is when you, or more tricky really, is when you're taking those sorts of requirements and putting them into a different context. So when you put it into everyday context, that's when it becomes really difficult.
Mm-hmm. Can you give an example?
Well, so there was an example of a project that we'd worked on, which was not so much about security, but it was about trying to introduce a really specific sequence that people went through in the mornings. And it was to try to encourage people to use a certain part of the building. It was to make sure that they wanted basically to have people interacting, sharing information, and that would support the work that this company did. And to try to encourage this, there was a whole set of things that were programmed into the building in the morning. So things like lifts would only go to the top floor. There was then a cafe that people would meet at, and lifts, a different bank of lifts would take people down. All of these things were happening. And on one level, you can see how when you're introducing those sorts of processes into a daily, into daily life, and it's not expected, that that could become a real inconvenience. And what we'd heard was that one of the things that we were saying was that maybe it was trying to force people to go through something that they weren't so keen to do. And we heard that not that long after the building was being used, people were finding ways around it.
Yeah.
They were finding ways to, things like opening the fire exit doors so people could use the fire escapes instead of following the proper sequence.
Yeah. So there's this often talked about difference between the design and the user experience. So that's a great example. And for those of you listening to the podcast, if you can use some background conversations, that's because we are on site, obviously, and we are recording at the 15th level of the Art Hotel in Battersea. And you just describe the difference between what the designers thought would be the right thing to do and the users think is the right thing to do.
Yeah.
What do you think, what impact does that have on the psychological comfort?
So, I mean, well, first of all, there's a really interesting part, because that was why our company existed, was the difference between when people design something to be used in a particular way and actually that when a user is actually using it, they might not use it in the way it's intended.
Yeah.
So you get a whole series of unintended consequences as a result of that. And so that was what led to research, and that led to this whole stream of research at UCL about the way that spaces fit together, the way that people, when you are in a space, the way that you look around and you can see into particular places, the way that you move according to what you can see. So the basis for the company was to try to understand what are the ways that people relate to space and how can you shape space in a particular way. Mm-hmm. That encourages or discourages certain behavior.
And what was something that you found out in this data analysis that surprised you in the way people use space?
Well, so there's a few things. There's different things at different scales. So sometimes we might look at a whole country, at a whole city, or sometimes within a building itself. One of the really interesting things is that people tend not to follow the absolute shortest route between A and B.
Okay.
They tend to follow the route that goes through the least change of angle. And so, and a lot of times that has to do with what you can see. So if you're in a public space or you're in a building, often the routes that people will take will be kind of a diagonal line through something, because that's where they can see they want to go. And that's the kind of it's the least change of angle. When you're moving across a city, what you find is that if you're going, say, from here to the city or to the other side of town, basically, people generally start to head in the right direction. And that might be a longer, if you measured the distance, that might actually be longer. If you're going to take those kind of taxi driver routes, all the back streets and the kind of wiggly routes, that might be a shorter path, but it's much more difficult for people to remember that. And so there's this really interesting thing about the way that people perceive space in their head, build up this picture of how everything fits together. and then actually move through spaces on the ground.
And I know that from myself as well, when I'm in a city for the first time and I look at the map and I have the choice between, let's say, a kilometer of distance, if I take all the angles, or if I go just straight and then turn left one time, I will definitely take the second option. Yeah. Have you ever observed that kind of behavior with yourself?
I think it's really difficult because as soon as you know that people might do that, you don't know if you're behaving completely naturally, if you've been kind of...
biased.
Yeah, but you're biased according to what you think people do. So I don't know is the answer.
Okay. Based on what you experience with the difference between user experience, people behavior in cities and buildings, what advice would you give young architects when they design cities for people?
I think the advice is what you said at the end. I think it's to design cities for people. And I think one of the problems, I think, is that things have become very siloed. There's a lot of different professions. They're all quite sophisticated. They've all got their own ways of doing things. So you have like a traffic engineer and you have an infrastructure engineer and you have all of these different specialists. They all have their own data. They all have their own tools. They all have their own ways of looking at things and thinking about things. And actually, one of the risks of that is that you can optimize a city or a part of the city for one of those systems. And often it's people that fall quite a long way down the list. So you might, I mean, you can see this in probably the second half of the 20th century onwards, that a whole load of cities just became optimized around driving around by car. And you might be able to drive across the city at, I don't know, 50 miles an hour or something, but you then can't cross the street to buy a pint of milk.
Got it.
And so it's really to think about people, and it's to use people as this way of integrating all of these systems together and not to prioritize vehicles over people and to make things really work from the perspective of a person.
And what advice would you give younger architects with the security aspect in mind as well?
So I think there's a lot of what would be principles of good urban design, which can also support security. So things like, if you think, when you're in a street and you're walking around, what makes you feel safe and what makes you feel less safe? I know, and again, some of this becomes difficult to unpick, because as soon as you start to think about these things, you don't know, do I really feel safe in this place? Or is it because I think this is what makes people feel safe that I'm looking for them? And so it's kind of, it's like confirmation bias. But I mean, as an anecdote, I can, one really clear example. So I think what really helps is having other people around. But it's a bit like a kind of a Goldilocks thing. It's like not too many people, not too few people. I think it means about having a relationship between people inside buildings and the street or the space outside them, being able to feel that there's some kind of connection. The anecdote was going to be back in 2011 when it was the riots in London. I was walking home. I was going through the streets that I always walked home through. It wasn't late. It was only about 6 p.m., but they were completely empty. All the shutters were down. There was very few people on the street. Buses weren't running, all of these things. But what was really clear was that it felt completely different and it felt really unsafe. And there wasn't any passers-by around. There wasn't, if something happened to me, there was nobody that was going to help or could kind of get involved in some way. So I think there's a couple of things. One is about that direct visual relationship and this physical thing of being co-present around other people. The other was that when it was the riots, it was really clear that there was a different set of rules in operation, that the normal rules didn't work anymore because all the police were busy doing other things. And that was the other thing that was a bit scary, was this thing of saying, not only are there not many people around, I know the normal rules of everyday life don't apply at this time. So I think the good urban principles, to link it back, would be these things about creating spaces that people use without thinking about, so that you get co-presence and you get people in the same space at the same time, trying to animate those spaces or make relationships between the people in the buildings and the spaces around them, locating things like entrances in the spaces so that people are coming and going and these sorts of things. And they're just general kind of urban design principles.
And looking into the future, what do you think, how will that concept of freedom develop in urban spaces generally?
I think this is where there's some really tricky things to work through, partly because of technology. And I could imagine how people could be sold on this idea of kind of invisible security. And I think one of the risks of that is that if there's some kind of invisible security, it's going to depend to an extent on some tech solution. And that probably means profiling things. It means collecting data. It means profiling things. all of these solutions have to be developed in a way that is not biased by the data sets that are going into them. So there's a whole load of questions about the way that those layers could be created. I think there's also a set of questions that are, what if I'm one of the people that is not seen as being safe? Or what if I'm one of these people that, I mean, it's not that difficult to imagine kind of these dystopian scenarios where you're not allowed into a part of the city because you haven't got the right thing, or your phone doesn't give the right signal to this place which is checking it, or you can't use the bus or something like this. And I think there's a real big risk there, because you can potentially exclude lots and lots of people from that. And that can make people really frustrated. It can be it could be confusing. Why is it happening? And that's going to have a direct impact on the lives of people as well. So it's a real balance.
Can you share a project that either you're currently working on or that you have been working on that brings both of these sides together? So that feeling secure, feeling safe and welcome on one hand, and the security aspect at the same time, where this was aligned.
Yeah, one of the things that we did was we did a piece of research that was looking at the effect of adding security interventions into the public realm, seeing what happened. And that was really about how you can protect certain places against particular threats, but it was also about minimizing the disruption to everyday life. And it was about minimizing the potential negative impact on someone who's just going to work and doing their normal stuff. So we did a lot of research looking at very busy places and looking at what happened, filming things, looking at what happened before and after security interventions were implemented. And there were some things that were really unexpected, but also helped to kind of align things. So one of those things was that actually, when you start to put physical elements into a crowd flow, it can actually help improve the crowd flow. So there are certain places where you might get, we were talking earlier about desire lines and about how people follow the route which is most direct, and they follow where they're going. So when people come out of a station, often they're looking into the surrounding area and they're choosing a particular route. And what happens is that when you get these desire lines crossing, that creates lots of potential places where people can bump into each other. But what you can do is you can start to put physical things like bollards to help structure that movement. So you can, if you do it very carefully, you can find particular places that mean you're not just protecting the building, but you're helping to make the space kind of easier to use on a daily basis. So you can try to, you can do it so that you can remove some of those potential conflicts between people.
And can you share, because we'd like to hear more about your projects, can you share a project that you are particularly proud of, where you feel like, well, we did a great job with that because of, and what makes it exciting or challenging?
I would say that a lot of the projects which I'm proud of will be because they would have had a particular outcome, or they would have put in place a set of conditions that would then allow a wider impact to happen. And that might be about making somewhere safe, but it might be about putting in place the conditions that make it possible for somewhere to be more healthy, more walkable, or something like that. Some of the projects I think that have maybe been more influential might not actually have been projects that have led to buildings or public realm projects, but it might be projects that have created tools that other people can use. So I think that's a really interesting thing, is that actually one of the things that we've been working on more recently has been to create data sets that explain things about where people are more likely to walk, where it's possible to walk, the routes they're going to take, and using that to address problems like climate change and health, which I know is not directly related to security, but there can be overlaps between them.
And what do you think? What city have you been that you find, what, this city is human-centered, the design is human-centered? What city evokes that thought?
Yeah, so, well, I live in London and I really like London, and London is really different in different parts. And it's very different, say, where we are now compared to the part I live in and the part I work in. But there's some parts of it is really very human. And what I think that means is that the way the grid of streets fits together means that you know where you're going, you can see where you're going. The urban blocks aren't too big, they're easy to walk around. Spaces are not filled with traffic that's driving very fast. There's space for people. All of these things all overlap at the same time. So, I mean, London's really interesting because it has pockets which are really good. It has pockets that need to improve. I always also think of Barcelona as I really like Barcelona, probably for similar reasons, that it has places that, again, seem to be, they manage to combine lots of things together and they don't lose sight of making pleasant spaces for people.
Mm-hmm. If you could choose to redesign one city somewhere in the world, and you would be the responsible project lead and architect for the design of the city. And for those of you who cannot see Ed's face right now, he's beaming. What city would you love to redesign to make human friendly and secure and feel everyone, have everyone feel welcome?
That's a
beautiful
really
question.
Good question.
Yes, I like it too.
Yeah, and it's a really difficult question as well. I'm probably going to give a terrible answer, which is to say that actually I think the most interesting things to work on are the ones where you have the least choice. So in some ways it might be easier mm-hmm. to be given a city to okay. then work out
yeah.
what do you then do with it.
Uh-huh.
I think the ones which are definitely the most challenging are the ones really from the second half of the 20th century. Those ones which have grown really rapidly, mm-hmm. that have grown at a kind of industrial scale where all of these big kind of global conditions have overlapped at the same time, where it's almost kind of been industrial urbanization, by which I mean the scale and the way that the speed that it's happened. So things like where you have large motorway networks laid out, you have big bits of land subdivided, you have things which are zoned, they've created loads and loads of problems. And actually overcoming them is really, really difficult. And it means getting involved in things and really looking at it in detail and trying to stitch things back together. So there would be a lot of the, I would say, cities in the Middle East. There's lots of cities in China like that. Lots of bits of US cities. So,
so they're the real ones. Population, how many million probably?
Probably from anywhere from 1 to 10, something like that. Maybe, yeah, 3 to 5.
Okay.
Something like that.
So the challenging ones, big populations from a central European perspective.
Yeah, well, the other thing I spent a long time working on, I spent 6 or 7 years working on slums, working at how do you improve slums without demolishing them, without displacing everybody who works there.
How do you improve
slums?
Well,
it is really interesting because as soon as you start to look at them, they have developed in a really human scale. A lot of them have been built by the people that live there. So they're built by the things people can carry. The things like their street networks and the urban blocks are based on how easily you can walk around. So we looked at slums in a particular context where they did have problems. They didn't have the infrastructure they needed. They didn't have the legal conditions in place. It was illegally occupied land. They were self-built. So they had all these problems. But at the same time, they were the most sustainable parts of the city. They were the only parts of that city where you could walk around. You had mixed use, you had high density, but it was low rise. And the other parts of that city, you could only get around by driving. So it was really, really interesting. And what we started to do was visited all these places. We did a lot of analysis of the street networks to see the hierarchies they had.
Yeah.
And what we could see was that they had a very local spatial network that was completely disconnected from the wider city.
Yeah.
And what that meant was that people were less likely to pass through them. As less people passed through, it meant it was more difficult to support businesses. So the businesses went out of business. Also, there was a kind of a social segregation that nobody, because nobody went through these areas, they never really questioned anything they heard about them. So we would hear these stories like these places are really dangerous and all this stuff. And actually, they weren't really dangerous, but no one would question it because they were never exposed to it.
I wanted to tie it back to the original topic. So did you feel safe when you walked through these slums?
Yes and no. In some, yes. In others, not so much.
Okay.
One of them, no, because there was, this is probably about 10, 15 years ago, somebody was taking photos that I was with and that wasn't very popular. And so there was a group of kids chased us. So that was when I didn't feel safe, but the rest of the time
I can understand that, yes. But the rest of the time
you did feel safe and you didn't have things like traffic driving around. You didn't have really fast cars. You could get out and walk around and things like that. So on that level you felt very safe.
You've done that for 6 or 7 years, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
That would be interesting. My mom's from the Philippines, so I know these areas that you talked about. That would be interesting. See, and what change did you create or did you gather data from that area?
Yeah, well, so this was really interesting, was that there's lots of data that's really difficult to get. The core of what we did was taking the network of space and analyzing the hierarchies in the space. So that was how we could see, that's how when we look at the way that people move across a city, and when people are taking the most direct route, or the one that goes through the least change of angle, we can analyze the network of space using that understanding. And that will pick out certain spaces are very well connected. We know those spaces are going to be used, and that has these other impacts on local economies and health and those sorts of things. So from things like satellite data, we could extract that. We could make those models. We could then target particular interventions to reconnect them into the wider city. We were really lucky on that project that we inherited a survey by, I think there was a university that had been working on there that had collected lots and lots of data on buildings. So like the age, the condition, the materials, the uses, what infrastructure they had, what utilities they had, all of these things. And what we could do was develop an index that would talk about how good the building was. So we could say there's this particular characteristic in slums where they're disconnected from the wider city. So they need to be connected in some way. So you might need to do some spatial intervention to reconnect it, but you should only do the absolute minimum. And what we could do was use this other data set to cross-check it and say, okay, if we need to reconnect it, this building's in really bad condition, and actually maybe that one wouldn't be so bad, but this one is really good and we should do everything we can to keep this one. So we could use those things together. There was loads of data that we just didn't exist. So there was data about the people that lived there, what their backgrounds were, what their jobs were, that just didn't exist in a digital format. So we would go to places and speak to the people that lived there and find things out. But that's a different, probably more qualitative way of using the data.
You have a very special view on cities as systems, especially combined with the data. So what would you say, what role do architects play in changing cities or making them more human friendly?
Yeah, so I'd say that there's a really clear way of framing, using the framing of the city as a complex system to frame the impact that architects can have and the outcomes they can try and shape. And so to explain that a bit more, I mean, one of the things is, first of all, to talk about what a complex system is. And there's this general description of a complex system is something that is made up of lots of smaller parts, individual systems. They interact with each other. They create emergent effects. Those effects create feedback loops, and that changes things. And the effect of those feedback loops. So to explain this a bit more, we've done a lot of work looking at health. Health is really interesting, but really difficult as well, because it's really complex outcomes. So if you take something like obesity, there are a whole set of things that affect whether somebody is overweight or not. And that might be the factors, it might be what the conditions they inherit, it might be the diet they have, the job they do, and the food they can afford, and these things. But part of it is how active you are every day. And part of how active you are every day is, does the city support you? Does it make it possible to walk to work, to walk to school, all of these sorts of things? So one of the things we can start to do is to say that we can, if you're an architect, you can't, or a designer, if it's the big societal questions and issues at the moment, they're really big and they're really difficult to deal with. We shouldn't overclaim what we can do, but we should understand where it is that we can contribute and what effect that can have. So to give a really a more tangible example, we can explain really clearly what makes somewhere walkable. Mm-hmm. So we can talk about the way the grid of streets fits together, the way that land use is distributed, the way public transport fits together, density, all of this stuff. And we can explain how that relates to where people walk and where they don't. Now, we can't guarantee, if we make everywhere really walkable, that you won't have obese people, because you still might have people inheriting a condition and these sorts of things.
Yeah, that's
but we can be really precise about how to make it walkable.
Yeah.
So there's then part of this as well is, once you have this understanding of a system, the way these systems fit together affects a set of daily activities, and that has a longer term impact on things like, it might be obesity, it might be climate change. You can then start to use that to structure data. And there's a lot of stuff at the moment about data that's available, and lots of things around how live or real-time data is the answer to everything. If you put it back into that framework of the systems, the activities that happen and the outcomes, then actually you can start to see there's a really clear difference between all of these things. And what we really need is data that explains the systems and how they fit together. So information on the street network, the hierarchies within the street network, how that means that certain places are more used than others. But we need to be able to show how that relates to how many people are in the street at a certain time. We need to look at both of those things together. You can't explain one without the other. If you only use the data, say from Google, that tells you there's this many people in this space, That's telling you what happens, but it doesn't tell you why it happens.
Mm.
If you don't know the way that the systems are configured and the way that they fit together and they create their own structures, you can't explain why those things happen. So you can't expect to be able to change it with any certainty. Yeah. So you need this really scientific way of thinking. If you can then put in place the physical conditions to allow this activity, you can then hope to change the long-term outcomes. But because it's a complex thing, you can't guarantee it.
Yeah.
But the role, I think what's really clear is that architects and designers, the built environment is important to these things. And we can be really clear to describe the particular characteristics that people should try to set in place to allow these things to happen.
Yeah. And the only way to have an impact as a designer is to design the places the way that you described it. Can you give an example, a city that you find walkable?
Yes, I can. I'm going to try and remember one while I answer it. We were talking earlier about how London's very different in different places, and there are different parts of London become very, some are very walkable, some are less walkable. The things that make places walkable tend to be that they have a very, they have a smaller urban grain. So urban blocks would typically be no longer on one edge than 100 to 200 meters.
Mm-hmm.
That's still quite big, but 100, it takes about a minute to walk 100 meters. So not too big an urban block. That those urban blocks are arranged in a grid of streets, which is continuously connected. So not full of kind of cul-de-sacs, but is continuously connected.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't have to be a grid. It can be distorted in some way, but it's really helpful if every street that you're in, you can at least get into a number of other streets,
mm-hmm.
probably four or five other streets from that one. And also to make sure that you end up with land uses that are distributed all over the place. So you don't just end up with places which are only residential or only employment, that you have a mix, but that mix of uses varies across the city.
When you book your holidays, your vacation, do you look at cities from that angle? Like, okay, what city would I like to walk through to experience live?
Before I had children, I used to do that. I haven't done that for quite a long time. Yeah, sometimes there are cities that you know or are aware of that have a kind of an urban buzz. And I think that urban buzz will come from some of these things. It might be about how many people are in the street, why they're there, the stuff that happens as a result of people being in the street. So I think you do kind of have an idea of some of the cities that generate that and other cities which are kind of maybe less interesting or have less of that. But I don't want to name or shame any of the...
I noticed that because whenever I ask you, can you name it? So can you give an example? You're describing it, but you're not giving the name. Except for Barcelona.
Barcelona.
As a positive example.
Well, places like New York also has that. I mean, there's lots of places, lots of really good European cities do it.
Is there one city that you have not visited yet that is kind of on your bucket list?
When I was about 9 months old, I got taken on holiday to Rome and I haven't been back since. And I obviously can't remember anything about it, but that would be...
You said you were 9 months old? Is that what you said? And you can't remember? How can that be? How can that be?
So yeah, that feels like somewhere that I should see again.
Okay.
Yeah.
Are your children old enough to take them to Rome?
Maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe for a weekend.
See? You're welcome. That's your next vacation idea. You're welcome. What are you looking forward to take away from the summit?
I would say it's lots of conversations with other people and to find out, are people thinking about or worried about the same things? Do people have the same concerns about fragmented society and this thing of the secondary, the kind of unintended impact of increasing security is potentially to fragment things further? And I think the one of the big concerns or risks is that actually security is a way of treatment to a societal problem, but it's not the prevention of it. And I would say possibly it's a shorter term response to some of these things around polarized societies or fragmented societies, and the problem and the way that those problems become apparent is through the things that we're trying to protect through security. So it would be interesting to hear if people are worried about the same things.
And you are in the perfect spot to discuss that. And I am very, very proud of you because when Ed arrived, he got a laptop full of notes. So you know how many times you looked at your laptop screen?
It's not even on.
Zero. See, very good job. I think I'm so happy that we had that conversation. You didn't even, of course, you didn't need the notes. I knew that. Ed Perham, thank you very much for being my guest here. I wish you a fantastic experience.
Thank you. At the summit.
Thank
you.
Looking forward to seeing you again someday.
Thanks.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much. And see and hear you in the next episode.
That was Because It Matters, a Dorma Kaba podcast. New episodes every month wherever you can listen to a podcast and on dormakaba.com.